Welcome to Biceps and Banter with expert trainer Brandon Crow. Hold on to your dumbbells and get ready for this conversational style podcast focused on interesting everyday dribble with tasty tidbits of health-related information sprinkled in. Enjoy.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Biceps and Banter. I'm here with Roland Pankwich, and we talked about all things sleep-related, why sleep is so important, the optimal amount of sleep, the difference between artificial and natural light, and various tactics that he's doing to optimize his sleep quality and quantity. I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. I've had Roland on previously. We talked about gut health. So if you want to go back and search for that episode, you would search under Roland Pankwich. Roland's just an all-around bright guy, and I think you're really going to get a lot from this episode, so make sure you take great notes. And without further ado, on to the episode. All right, Roland, we're back at it.
So, we are back.
So if you missed the episode I did with Roland previously, we talked all about gut health. Go back in the episodes to check that one out. I think you'll really enjoy this that episode. In this one, we're going to be taking a deep dive in sleep, talking about things that Roland's doing to optimize his sleep. We all know sleep is important, but what does sleep actually do for us? Like, why is this obsession with sleep, getting a certain number of sleep and quality of sleep, what does sleep do for us?
Well, fundamentally, the most important aspect of sleep is the whole idea of regeneration, right? Sleep is a cyclical activity, meaning the body goes through different stages and where it emphasizes the healing, reparation, and restoration of different aspects of health. So, you know, with REM sleep, you help with neurological stuff, forming short-term memories into long-term memories. With certain aspects of deep sleep, that's when your body will release things like growth hormone, promote the regeneration of tissues. So, you know, there are a multitude of reasons why we sleep, but I always try to come back to the most important point to remember what it is I want to communicate to other people, and sleep is regeneration.
So if people aren't getting enough sleep, they're not getting that regeneration.
You're not recovering in any context, no. Well, think about it like this. You've had a night where you've slept for 3 hours. How do you feel the next day? Physically, mentally, emotionally?
Awful.
Your blood sugar's a mess. Your hunger cravings are all over the place. Your mood's irregular. So for a human to achieve optimal health, as they define it, it's impossible to achieve without making sleep a massive priority, because staying awake for too long or not sleeping enough always pushes you in the wrong direction towards illness.
Now, I'm finding that people aren't prioritizing sleep as much as maybe they used to in the past. It seems that everybody's very go, 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 checking their, you know, Facebook and Instagram and text messaging. Have you noticed any, or are there any trends associated with people getting less sleep and, say, for instance, prevalence of certain diseases?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the data in terms of the average number of hours that someone slept compared to what they did 10, 20, 30 plus years ago, it's been slowly regressing. I think the average is somewhere in the six and change range. And I think the reason is a multitudinal of mixed factors. Number one, you're right, we're on a go-go-go society, especially in the Western world. And go-go-go requires what's called a sympathetic dominant nervous system state. So that's kind of a fight-or-flight state chronically. And think about this, if you get really excited or if you get really stressed out, do you feel like sleeping immediately after that? No. You're awake, you're alert, you're ready to fight, flight, whatever. So if we're chronically in a sympathetic nervous dominant state, then our body is always pumping out stress hormones. When we're pumping out stress hormones, we don't allow our bodies to access the rest and digest side of that nervous system, which is called parasympathetic. So the most parasympathetic activity I can think about is something like meditation or deep breathing, relaxation, long walk in a, well, like kind of what we're doing in a outside nature-based area. So the fact that we're so stressed out in the Western world not only affects the quality of our sleep, but it also affects the quantity of our sleep. Affects the quantity of our sleep because our bodies really aren't optimized to actually fall asleep. We're basically fighting off stress hormones the entire time. To layer that, our environment is so much different than it used to be. If we didn't have lights, we didn't artificially illuminate in our environment, how would we be able to dictate when we stayed awake and when we were sleeping? It's by when the sun sets. So if we can artificially illuminate our environment when the sun goes down, our bodies actually perceive light frequency to help keep us awake versus help prepare us for sleep. So if you're on your phone in the evenings, if you're watching TV, if you're doing work on the computer, your body essentially perceives that light as something similar to a sunrise. So not only are you not sleeping, but you're compromising your body's ability to go through the proper stages of sleep and the adequate number of sleep cycles every night. To finish your question, I don't see a client who's not well who sleeps well, if that makes sense. I've never met a client who is on a path to health who doesn't have some aspect of their sleep disturbed, be it not being able to fall asleep because their thoughts are racing, not being able to stay asleep, they wake up at random times or maybe the same time every day in the middle of the night. And then when they wake up, they don't feel rested. They know they slept 6-7 hours, but they don't feel like they slept at all. And that's a problem because you know your body's not actually getting the benefits of the recovery as a result of doing so.
Mm-hmm. So how much sleep is quote unquote optimal? Like I do have some clients that say on 4 or 5 hours sleep, I feel great. Is that them just telling themselves a story, or is there an optimal number that we do need, like everybody should need?
It's interesting, right? Because you hear, oh, sleep 8 hours a night, blah, blah, blah. I think there are individual cases where some people do best on less sleep. Maybe not best, but they can survive just fine. It doesn't cause them problems. And some people just need more sleep by nature. It's just them uniquely. One of the interesting things you can look at is something called your chronotype. And there are four basic chronotypes, and they relate them to animals. There's the dolphin, there's the bear, there's the lion, and there's one more that always escapes me. And this alludes to the style of sleep that best suits you. Some people do really well going to bed early, and they get up at the crack of dawn, and they're full of energy. Some people do the best when they stay up a little bit later, kind of like a night owl, and they sleep later. So that's a big thing. The individuality of how you respond to sleep is an important aspect. What I always try to do is I look at total duration of sleep in response to sleep cycles. We have various stages of sleep. We have shallow sleep to deep sleep. We have rapid eye movement, and we cycle through those once every 90 to 120 minutes. It's usually about every hour and a half. So what I try to do is if I know it's every 90 minutes, I multiply the number of cycles and I try to figure out how many I can get within a 6 to 8 hour period. So there's some research to say that 8 hours might be actually worse for you if you wake up in the middle of a deep sleep cycle because you wake up feeling like absolute shit. You know what I mean? Whereas every so often, if you're in a sleep cycle, as you come out and go back into a shallow sleep cycle, you actually wake up for a very short period of time. But you don't perceive you waking up because you're essentially still sleeping. So I don't know if you've ever done this. You set your alarm for 7:30 in the morning, but you wake up naturally at 6:45.
Right.
It's actually better in that case to get up then because your body naturally woke up than go back into the start of another cycle and wake yourself up in the middle of a deep sleep.
Okay, so it's better to finish a full cycle.
Correct. Okay. So the duration, the amount of sleep, I think is less important than making sure that you're actually waking up at an appropriate time in the sleep phase. That being said, if that sleep duration is 2 hours, that's a problem. So it's within a given night, 6 to 8 hours is what you want to aim for, but waking up naturally with a sleep cycle is always better than just saying, oh, it has to be 8 hours regardless. I hope that explains.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So is there a perfect number of sleep cycles you should be getting, or?
I think 5 to 6 is probably what most people should aim for.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's important that when you do sleep, you set the tone for sleep rather than just jump into bed after doing something that could be an arbitrary activity, like exercise, because exercise right before bed will raise your stress hormone levels. Or, you know, watching something on TV without some kind of eye protection, or watching something that causes an emotional or excited response. I mean, like, no one goes to bed and sleeps well after watching a horror movie.
That's right. Yeah, I've been trying to do a lot more of that myself, starting to wind down before bed, dimming the lights, putting on candles, you know, putting on my salt crystals, and maybe reading a book.
Yeah, my mentor, Dr. Ted, he uses this thing called the sleep anchoring technique. And a big thing that I always try to do with people is I try to change their perspectives. Oftentimes, if you have a rigid perspective of something, you're so locked into a tunnel vision way of looking at things that you might not actually be doing the best thing that you can for yourself. So the perspective with sleep is you create a sleep anchoring technique by considering going to bed the beginning of your day. Mm. Not the end of your day.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Because when you start with a sleep anchoring technique, you know that that is the most important thing in order to start your day off right, by getting the proper night's rest. So you do everything that you can to plan an optimal night of sleep, so that when you wake up, you know that you're going to wake up feeling refreshed, you continue your day, and the momentum of that and the habitual behavior carries through.
So sleep anchoring technique, maybe talk about that. Are you talking about different scents that you can put on or different routines that you can go through?
So everything encompassed in that. The most important thing is being consistent with a sleep-wake time. Obviously, if you go out on the weekends occasionally, whatever, it's not going to be a big deal. One night here, one night there if you're healthy. What I do from a sleep anchoring technique perspective is I have kind of like my series of steps that I follow before bed. Mm-hmm. First of which, like you said, you pick a shutdown time. So if I'm doing something work-related, and unless the world's going to end tomorrow, I'll deal with it the next day. You know, if someone's, oh my God, it's 11 o'clock and I need this. If it's not your responsibility to do that, say, pardon my language, F it. I'm just going to go to bed. It's more important that I'm fresh to do a better job tomorrow than I am to stay up to 1 in the morning and bang out some piece of shit that I might actually, you know, regret doing. Mm-hmm. From there, I try to avoid electronics as much as possible. So light frequency is very important for regulating what's called your circadian rhythm. Circadian rhythm is essentially your body's ability to perceive what time of day it is based upon environmental exposure, light being the most powerful one. So if I'm looking at a computer screen, one of those energy efficient bulbs like halogen bulbs or very bright LEDs, I tell people to get those out of their life. Why? Because they are very blue light dominant. Blue light, which is very high energy, is attractive to electronics companies because it provides a lot of illumination, but it doesn't draw a lot of power. But the body senses blue light as highly, highly stimulatory. So if you look at a computer screen without like a covering over the screen or without some kind of app like Flux or blue light blocking technology on your phone, for example, then you're getting that dominant blue light, and your eye, which is a camera, but it's also a clock. Your eye can perceive the world around you based upon light frequency, and if it sees blue light, that's a signal to be awake. So it will raise stress hormone levels, it can raise cortisol levels, and from a sleep perspective, when you raise cortisol, you reduce melatonin. And melatonin should be secreted in response to darkness, because that's the hormone that helps regulate the whole sleep regeneration process, especially neurologically. It's your second most important neurological antioxidant behind glutathione. Maybe even more important in some cases. So melatonin helps you clear out old waste and cellular debris inside the brain and essentially regenerate the activity and the health and the physiological aspects of neurons, dendrites, all the communication gap molecules that actually help optimize our brain function.
So how much blue light would it take? Say, for instance, if I just flip open my phone and check Instagram for 10 seconds, 15 seconds, does it automatically disrupt that process?
Theoretically, yes, because think about it from this way. How has nature timed it? What color is the sun when it sets?
Like a red,
orangey,
yellow.
Red.
Yeah.
So if you get any blue light when the sun has gone down, you've disrupted that natural rhythm. Even if it's 10 seconds, it has an effect. How much? It's hard to say. It's hard to say that, 10 seconds of phone exposure equals a 50% reduction in melatonin secretion. But knowing that that process happens both ocularly in the eye and neurologically in the brain, if your goal is to optimize your sleep, don't look at your phone after a certain hour. Or if so, do it with some very, very heavy-duty blue light blocking glasses if you need to look at electronics. I mean, I'm guilty of doing it too.
Right.
My biggest problem is I travel all the time. So when someone asks me, what do I do in my sleep? My first question is, in what time zone? So that's my biggest struggle, right? Because I change time zones every month. But if you can regulate your time zone and your sleep cycle, it's the habitual behaviors that you engage in on a regular basis that will optimize your body's ability to sleep well, sleep soundly, and then sleep consistency, because the body responds to consistency signals. If you do one thing for a week, and then you change it up the next week, your body's been confused. The stimulus or the response that it gives to the stimulus is not consistent.
Right, so it doesn't necessarily matter what time zone you're in, it's those bedtime rituals that are most important. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they're important once you've responded, you've adjusted to the time zone.
Mm.
I try to do what I can to shortcut my body's ability to respond to my change in time zone with things like light frequency and physiological and biological aids, certain sleep substances or things to aid sleep. But fundamentally, yeah, the most important aspect of anything when it comes to health is lifestyle habits and what you engage in on a consistent basis.
Mm-hmm. I saw those really cool blue light blocking those stylish shades that you have.
Haha, yes.
So when do you put those on? When the sun starts going down?
I put them on when the sun starts to set and I'm inside. So my goal is to wear those every evening. Now, the ones that I have that are actually nice frames, they don't block all the blue light. They only block the highest energy blue, typically coming from computers. So they're designed, they're by a company called Blue Tech. And if you want to do some research into this, you can look at the different nanometers. That's the wavelength measurement of light. So you have infrared on the left-hand side, which you can't see, but you can feel. It's heat.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever been in an infrared sauna, mm-hmm. you know that it makes you sweat a little bit differently because the infrared penetrates your skin and your body absorbs it. On the far right, you have ultraviolet, UV. And UV, you can't see and you can't feel unless you've been out in the sun and you get super burned for too long. But neither one of them is good nor bad. People think, oh, ultraviolet light is bad for you. It causes skin cancer. That's a bunch of shit. It's a half-truth. It's not knowing the full spectrum. The difference between ultraviolet and infrared is just the amount of energy it carries. UV's got a much higher energy potential. But you don't get much UV during the day. You just get it from a specific period. Like right now, we're outside. It's, what, 11:30?
Yes.
So we can make UV B interact with our bodies and make vitamin D. You can only do that in Canada till about 2 p.m. So in that context, UV light is essential because most sick people have very low vitamin D statuses. Blue light is just one step down from UV, meaning it is the second most high energy molecule, or high energy photon is the proper technical term. So blue light carries a lot of energy, which impacts our physical selves more rapidly than some of the lower energy light forms do. So what I do is I try to avoid my eyes seeing blue light. And another important thing is your skin has photoreceptors. So your skin can absorb blue light and it can actually respond to the light frequency. UV light can actually raise your insulin levels. It can actually raise your signaling molecules to stimulate the release of cortisol and stress hormones. So our bodies are in tune with light frequency. That's how we're designed. We're not that much different than plants. Although we look kind of different and we don't just sit there and sustain off of stuff in the dirt. But fundamentally, we're all yoked or we're all tied and connected to the environment, and light is one of the most powerful physiological stimuli that our bodies can respond to.
So if somebody's wearing a sleep mask at night, but outside in their bedroom, it's still pretty bright. You're still absorbing that light.
If your skin's exposed, technically you are. Now, what you can do about that is you can actually buy specialized light bulbs, and I have a few of them in my house. You can buy bulbs that have a lot of the blue taken out of them, which, for example, I put in my bedroom because I know that I might have that light on at the end of the day. So if I have the least powerful spectrum taken out, so the most powerful spectrum taken out, I have the least effectiveness in terms of how that light's going to change my body. You can also buy red lights, things that are more red orange spectrum. So again, your body's more used to seeing that as the evening sets in, as the sun sets. So that's another strategy, is look for low light bulbs or low blue light containing light bulbs, and then use those where you spend the majority of your evening time once the sun has gone down.
All right, so if people have LED bulbs in their bedroom,
Energy efficient, like the super bright ones,
right? Yeah,
the ones that actually hurt your eyes to look at if you're not used to them. And the other terrible ones are those mercury filaments, the shit that we had in our classrooms at school.
Right.
So it makes sense. Think about it from the perspective of energy. If you touch an incandescent light bulb, a traditional light bulb, does it burn your hand?
Yeah, it hurts.
It's hot. Yeah. But when you touch an energy efficient light bulb, what happens?
It's cool.
There's no or actual there's, heat.
Yeah.
They've removed all the infrared. So that's the major power drain. So the light bulbs that are attractive to your budget when it comes to, you know, power and hydro and all that are actually hazardous to your health. I have a friend in California. He used to be an engineer, and he was on the project that was replacing all the streetlights in LA with these high energy bulbs. And they noticed that wildlife was starting to die out, and they start to get confused because they're not used to seeing high energy light at night. So it was actually killing off birds, and it would stop birds from migrating to certain local areas.
Wow.
And neighborhoods. Yeah, yeah.
So you gotta just think, like, what is it doing to us?
And think about it this way. It's not the one time you look at it. It might not even be for a week. But if you were to change out your light bulbs, within a month, few months, you would start noticing it. You'd be responding differently to the quality of sleep you got. And if you only did that, you're essentially imbalancing your own ability to regulate your sleep-wake cycle. And it all comes back to the same thing. It's the consistency of the physiological stimulus that you expose yourself to.
So you mentioned certain times of the day that it's best to get this certain spectrum of light that's coming in. Maybe let's go there. What time frame is best?
What I tell everyone is, if you have the ability, wake up in the morning before you even look at your phone, because that's what most people do first. Go outside and just let your body kind of wash in the morning sunlight, because that's the start button for your body to know, okay, it's morning, because it knows what the frequency is, and all the morning habits will be regulated most optimally. Your body releases hormones in the morning in response to sunlight, so the morning sunlight actually raises your cortisol. And that's good in the morning, because that's what gets you out of bed, gets you energetic, and it creates a bit of a momentum for the day, because your body responds to that signal. So you don't have to look at the sun. Actually, don't look at the sun. That's probably never a good idea. But look in the direction of the sun, and it will bounce off of your lower eyelid, and the light frequency will actually be absorbed by your iris. If you can, from there, it's really, really important to get some midday sun exposure. In Canada, we don't make vitamin D outside of, I would say technically the beginning of April to maybe mid-October. And it's just because we're so far north relative to the equator that the ability of our bodies to expose themselves to UV light is only between the hours of, say, 10 a.m. or maybe 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. So I tell all my clients, you know, like, oh, I want to supplement with vitamin D. I just point up at the sky. I'm like, it's right there and it's free. And you can raise vitamin D levels with the sun without toxic consequence. If you try to hyperdose vitamin D, you can overdo it, number one. But I've also found this phenomenon that sometimes people can't raise their vitamin D with supplementation because they have defaulty vitamin D receptors. So, I mean, we're designed to bank it in the sun, or in the summer rather. And if you look at the northern climates, what do you notice about skin tone the further north you go?
Lighter.
You get whiter. And that's by design. Your skin's a solar panel. So what you do is you get much better at absorbing light from your environment, so you can make vitamin D faster. You can raise your levels because you can stockpile vitamin D for the winter. And as a result of that, you need less sun exposure. Someone who has very, very fair skin, like a redhead pigment, freckles, they can 6 to 8 minutes, they're probably good. Someone who's darker skin, they could take up to 50 minutes a day, but you want as much of your body exposed as possible. Your face and your arms typically is not enough.
So if somebody's getting adequate sun exposure in the summer, how long does that bank last? Does it last all winter long?
It's hard to say. I tell everyone to check their vitamin D levels just to be sure. Because again, everyone's different. If your body's under some kind of inflammatory stress, if you have an autoimmune disease, vitamin D is a lot more important to regulate the activity of your immune system, so you might blow through it faster.
So people that have problems with their vitamin D receptors, is it from just inadequate exposure to natural sunlight?
I don't know that there's necessarily one answer, other than some people do have a genetic defect with their vitamin D receptor gene. I would probably assume that it's, for some reason, their body's not able to harness light from their environment. It could be something skin-related, could be something inflammatory-related, because typically receptors are always proteins on the surface of a cell, and if that protein is misfolded, deformed, if there's a lot of inflammation, it's misshapen, it doesn't work the same way. It's kind of like a lock and key mechanism, right? Like the vitamin D receptor gene is designed to only bind vitamin D. But if the vitamin D molecule stays the same, but the receptor is deformed or disfigured, or the cell membrane isn't properly formed, then it's not going to work.
Like it won't fit into that lock
exactly.
and key.
Same thing with insulin and glucose, right? Eat carbohydrates, your body raises blood sugar, pancreas releases insulin, insulin docks at the cell receptor, glucose goes into the cell. Same kind of concept.
So in the summer when people are wearing shades, have their umbrella up, covered in sunscreen,
you're not making any vitamin D. I right. tell my clients, if you're going to be in the sun for a long period of time without the ability to hide from it, I mean, the most important thing you can do fundamentally is make sure, number one, that you do have some kind of shade, access to shade. I mean, look at animals. When they're out in the sun for too long, they'll just go under a tree. So I don't ever use sunscreen. Some people probably might scream at me, tell me I'm going to get skin cancer. Okay, that's cool. If you look at the statistics, people with the lowest vitamin D levels typically get the highest occurrences of skin cancer. The second thing is that once you have applied sunscreen to your skin, you block the ability to absorb UVB. We were talking beforehand, UVB doesn't penetrate very deep into skin tissue. So when you put a layer of cream that blocks or reflects the ultraviolet light, the UVB doesn't get absorbed, so your body doesn't actually make or raise blood levels of vitamin D. So you're basically blocking your ability to do the one thing that you hope to accomplish by being in the sun. Sunglasses, I don't wear them. I don't see the point. My eyesight's better than when I was a kid, and I'm 32 years old now. So I haven't worn sunglasses in probably about 2 years. Maybe if you're in the sun all day and your eyes start to fatigue, I can see the point. But if you put sunglasses on to block UV as well, again, it's going to confuse the brain if you always do it when you're outside and you've developed really sensitive eyes. When I have some clients take off their sunglasses, they complain that it hurts to be in the sun. I don't know what that's like anymore because I haven't put sunglasses on in about 2 years. But to each their own. I mean, if some people have, I don't know enough when we're talking about things like macular degeneration and glaucoma. I'm not an ophthalmologist or an optometrist in that sense. But again, it depends on the lens that you look through. I always look at, so evolutionarily, did humans have sunglasses before? No, they were okay. I don't know the eyesight quality of the indigenous people of North America before, you know, modern medicine came to be, but I would assume that not everyone went blind.
Right.
I'm going to go ahead and assume that, because that would be really hard to repopulate if everyone essentially went blind for, you know, at a young age.
I mean, it probably could even be argued that they had great eyesight. They have to go around hunting and,
yeah. You know. I mean, one thing that degenerates eyesight is also things like nutritional deficiencies, imbalanced anabolic-catabolic ratios in the tissues. To think that one thing will so profoundly affect everything in one way, I think is quite short-sighted.
So are there any specific supplements that you're taking or anything to help with your sleep that way in terms of supplementation?
My go-to because of my time zone shift is I use about 3 milligrams of melatonin until I've adjusted to my new time zone. Because one thing that doesn't get made properly when you adjust shift your time zone is the release of hormones. They get all confused. So I will use melatonin strategically. I don't like high doses because sometimes I find people wake up in the middle of the night after they have a very quick drop into sleep. And I will also look at some other agents. Like there are some good nutrients like certain magnesiums tend to help modulate the nervous system to calm it down. Magnesium L-threonate I like. Supplementally from an herbal perspective, you can use valerian root. So valerian is an herb that helps to bind excessive amounts of GABA. Well, GABA is your neurotransmitter that regulates rest, whereas glutamate is the one that excites you. So you can use valerian. Sometimes people get a little bit of a hangover from it, so it's to each their own. Vitamin B6 is important as well, because vitamin B6 does help with neurotransmitter formation. So converting serotonin to melatonin is a B6 dependent action. In the form of P5P is the one I typically get. And let me see what else. There are some other sleep aids out there. Just anything that's habit forming or becomes a dependency. For example, if you take a substance that helps you sleep, and once you've used it for a period of time, if you remove it, you're not sleeping, I would say that you still haven't fixed the problem you created in the first place. And that's usually a lifestyle thing. But yeah, to round that out, melatonin, certain magnesiums, valerian root, vitamin B6, and another one that works quite well is L-theanine, which is an amino acid, and it seems to induce a calming effect. And removing caffeine after 2 or 3 p.m. is pretty much a solid idea across the board for most people.
So can people overdo it with the dependency on melatonin? Like, I know some people that will take melatonin every single day. Are they messing up with their natural cycles at that point?
That's a great question. I don't know definitively, because the research on melatonin, there are people who advocate taking 15 grams a day. There are people who advocate time release. It's hard to say, because your body's still going to make it naturally. And it's a process that's dependent upon the environment around you. Theoretically, if you're going ultra physiological dose, it might not be the best thing forever. But I'm sure that at the same time, if you were to take small amounts of melatonin for a period of time, it probably won't give you any negative interactions. What I like to do is I like to measure all the hormones to see, you know, what's going on with the balance of the hormones that support anabolic building activities and catabolic breakdown activities, because melatonin's on the catabolic side of it. So that can actually be very effective for people who have ultra high cortisol, or even balancing out ultra high androgens like testosterone and estrogen. It would maybe be a safe thing to say if someone has a neurological disease, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, or any kind of brain inflammatory thing, that melatonin would probably be a good thing for them to be using on an ongoing basis. But it's individualistic. I don't like to give broad stroke advice to clients on podcasts, just because I practice personalized medicine. So I like to make sure that I'm trying to get the most accurate dose for them, taking into consideration all of their lifestyle variables.
But for the most part, you would say natural route is the best way to go.
Well, if you can do it naturally, yes. But you know, the biggest thing with getting clients to work in a context of regenerating their health, it's not intelligence, it's not understanding, it's compliance. You know, so if someone's a workaholic and they work all the time and they're not wanting to let up in the evening, then you might have to quote unquote biohack some of these things with supplements or substances, because that's the next best thing you can do. So it really depends on what your clients are after, but there are some very basic things, like everything that we've mentioned. If you were to make a list of it and create a sleep shutdown procedure, you can involve some meditation, deep breathing, certain musics or frequencies are very calming. Dark room, reading a book like you do, rather than reading something on an e-reader or a computer. You know, the things where you turn pages, people don't read books anymore because it's a bit archaic. But technology be damned, that's much better in terms of how our bodies are actually being exposed to light frequencies at appropriate times of the day.
So we talked about in the winter time, as Canadians, we're not able to get that same UV.
Yeah, we get no UVB after October till April.
So are there some things that you're doing in the winter? I know you travel a lot.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I go to the tropics once a quarter, so I just find a beach and just chill out. But if that's not an opportunity one has, believe it or not, using a tanning bed strategically can be a really good idea. Now, people say, oh, tanning bed is going to cause skin cancer. Well, if you ultimately dose yourself on UV all the time, yeah, you might induce some kind of inflammatory response in the skin because it's too much UV without the rest of them. What I suggest people do is two things. Number one, buy a UVB lamp from Amazon. And literally when you get out of the shower, because the shower is warm, it dilates and brings skin blood to the surface of the skin, sun yourself or lamp yourself, whatever the verb is, in front of the UVB lamp for 5 minutes, 6 minutes aside. Just stand in front of it naked in the comfort of your own bathroom or bedroom and just get yourself exposed to that UVB. The other thing you can do is you can find a tanning bed that has a higher amount of UVB in it, because UVA is actually the one that tans you. UVB is the one that makes vitamin D. So that would be my suggestion to people. And you know, you can do that for a few minutes a day if it's an at-home tanning lamp, and then maybe once, twice a week. The lowest amount of time on the bed with the highest amount of UVB will actually help you. You don't want to aim to get super dark. You want to aim just to get the exposure of UVB.
Right, so are all tanning beds, you mentioned some have more UVB and some...
UVA, yeah. UVA. The ones that tan you, you don't want to focus on in the winter. The ones that have more UVB in them, that's what's going to be beneficial for vitamin D levels.
Okay.
But it also typically makes people feel better, right? There are bright light devices as well, but you can do the same thing. You wake up in the morning, the sun rises earlier in the winter, so just look outside for a few minutes. And the cold is actually good for you. It stimulates cold hormesis, which is like a bit of a stress response, but it actually can stimulate your immune system to be stronger. The whole idea of catching a cold, you think about this for a second. A cold is not a temperature thing, it's a virus. So you don't go outside in the cold and catch a cold just by being cold. That just induces a shivering response. But if you look at Eastern cultures, typically Russia, Siberia, they take their kids at the age of 5 or 6 in the wintertime, throw them outside in a bathing suit and have them dump water over their heads because it doesn't make them sick as often. So there are some physiological benefits to doing stuff like that, but if you're outside, just throw on a sweater or a jacket, have your morning coffee, and just get 5 to 10 minutes of sun hitting your face. The effect in the winter still works.
So you're still going to get the light exposure, but you mentioned that you're not...
You're going to get blue light exposure in the morning, yes. So it helps to set your circadian rhythm for the day, prepares your body for the rest of the day, but you just don't get the UV as we spoke about, yes.
Oh, okay. Now, you mentioned meditation. Is that something that you'll do before bed, or is it a consistent thing, mornings, evenings?
I'm a very consistent meditator. I do different strategies and different styles. If we weren't doing this podcast right now, this is my walking meditation in the woods. So when I'm doing something like this, I actually just try to be as present as possible. I don't think. I'll ask myself, you know, what do I see? What do I feel? Stuff of that nature. And that helps to kind of center you to a greater degree. Or you just do something awareness, like feel your feet fall every time you take a step. Focus on the sounds, the smells. That's a daytime meditation technique for people who don't sit still well. Mm-hmm. I do meditation before bed every time. And it's kind of cool. It's almost like a way to travel outside of your body. You're becoming just the awareness itself. So you get a greater sense of, you know, connection of yourself to the universe if you look at it that way. But what meditation also does is it activates your sympathetic silencing and promotes your parasympathetic nervous system to upregulate. So the one that relaxes you. Your heart rate slows down. Your breathing becomes actually a little bit longer in between breaths. So that's a sign of you being, you know, fully, you're dilating your airways much better. Mm. And on top of that, meditation can actually activate, you know, the increase in gray matter in the brain, improve memory function. There's really not a negative to meditation. I think the only negative people have is just committing to sucking at it when you start, because the monkey mind starts.
Right.
But if you commit to it, you actually can get into this amazing groove where it becomes a cognitive benefit, a physiological benefit, a mental, and if you're a spiritual person, a very spiritual benefit. So I would suggest that if everyone could find some form of meditation, there's some apps like Headspace. That's a great way to start. They're guided, and the guy actually lets you distract yourself in the process. So it's like, I'll let your mind wander, think about whatever, so you're not trying to keep a lid on your thoughts for so long. What I tell people is just observe your thoughts. See what comes up. And as a result of that, don't judge them. Don't ask, why the hell did I just think that? Just see what the patterns and the trends are. Because oftentimes you can get clarity on something that you might be trying to figure out when you're in a meditative state. Because again, you're looking at it from a different perspective.
So people that have racing minds right before bed, maybe that's somewhere they can start.
If they can, absolutely. What I do sometimes is I do it just pure silence. I'll put a blackout blindfold on, and I'm there for half an hour, sometimes an hour. You can use music. There's some great meditative music choices on YouTube. You can focus on each individual chakra if that's something that you follow. Or you can do binaural beats, which are not necessarily music, but there are certain frequencies that can, I find at least, change your physical state pretty quickly. And they're also something to listen to, so you're not totally in silence. You're still, I don't want to say distracted, but there's something there that allows you to take comfort in focusing on that sound, not just sitting and listening to your own breath.
Hmm. So maybe for sleep specifically, you'd say maybe focus on meditation closer to night versus morning, or does morning also have carryover? It must have a carryover effect to the evening.
Well, yeah, because what you're doing is you're forcing a parasympathetic state. You're forcing a rest and digest state to start your day a certain way. Think of it this way. If you get up, an alarm blares, it's an irritating noise, and you have to rush in the morning, fight traffic, and have some shitty breakfast, pound a couple coffees. That's how you start your day, and that, I find, sets the tone for your day. I wake up much differently. I try to wake up in a relaxed state. I usually do at least a few minutes of some kind of morning breath work, focus on something gratitude-based, although that's becoming kind of like a cliche thing. I'm happy to be alive every day, man. Life is most excellent. So I just reflect on stuff like that. But I also, I do force myself to do that because, like the sleep anchoring technique, it anchors the start of your day. And then you do everything kind of ritualistic. If you drink coffee or tea in the morning, you know, that's the first physical activity you do. You make breakfast, you enjoy the process. And if you sleep better, you can wake up a little bit earlier and give yourself more time in the morning without feeling so bagged every time you wake up.
So if somebody has a really hectic schedule Monday to Friday, and they're only sleeping 4, 5, 6 hours Monday to Friday, and on the weekends they're sleeping 9 or 10, does that have any benefit? Is there such a thing as a sleep credit system where you can go into debt and then make up for it at a later time?
You can't bank sleep. That whole thing, oh, I'm catching up on my sleep. You never catch up on it. You're just changing your body's duration of sleep, which will be beneficial. If you sleep 3, 4, 5 hours a night, then the weekends you sleep more. It's still going to be better than keeping that 3 to 5 hours on average. But if you run a sleep debt, it only changes when you change your habits. It's like exercise. If you exercise for 20 years and then say, fuck it, I'm going to eat donuts every day for a year and not lift a muscle, can you bank exercise?
Right.
No, your body changes. So the same thing with sleep. You can't bank sleep. You can't quote unquote catch up on sleep. Like there's some line that you have to meet and then you maintain it. What you're actually doing is you're putting in two different signals for your physical health. So the key, and it's like anything, if you want to get better, if you want to get healthier, you have to schedule it in at first until it becomes innate. Then once it's innate, you need to maintain it as a priority. So think about this. High-performing people pride themselves on not being able to, you know, need 8 hours of sleep. That's just for a period of time. You might have a very tolerant system. You might be totally cool to sleep for 4 hours for like 6 years, but it's under the surface where everyone gets sick. The term I use is insidious. So if you want something like the greater chance of having neurological inflammation and developing a neurodegenerative disease, less sleep correlates with that very positively. If you want to trash your body composition and, you know, sleep very few hours, blow your insulin sensitivity, jack up your fasting blood sugar, raise your cortisol levels in the evening, by all means, go for it. Because you can't undo those things. It's day-to-day habits. That's how humans are built. We're meant to live in the moment. We're not meant to live in a future and past-focused scenario, in my opinion.
So would it be better for somebody to either wake up at a certain time every single day or go to bed at the same time every single day?
That would be optimal if you can regulate your sleep-wake cycle from a bedtime and a rising time. If you do it within, you know, half an hour of each other both days or within an hour, I don't think there will be negative consequences that are too detrimental. It's when you, like, you know, oh, I'm going to go to bed at 10, then on the weekends I go to bed at 2, and when you don't get into a good habit of regular sleep-wake cycle, that's when the problems start to arise.
Is there one that's more important than the other? Say, for instance, going to bed at a certain time?
Yeah, it seems that sleeping before midnight is very, very important. I think it's better to sleep early and wake up extra early than it is to sleep at, say, 2 a.m. and wake up at noon. Again, you're trying to look at how the day goes. Rhythmically, you're more in sync because the sun's more likely to set after 7 p.m. in the northern hemisphere for most of the year than as the sun starts to rise at noon. If anything, the sun rises earlier in the winter, which probably does affect our sleeping patterns as innate beings before the advent of modern electricity.
Now, we talked about the regenerative ability to regenerate at night. So I'm assuming that somebody that has a specific injury, it's important for them to get more sleep then.
Well, yeah, because all of your energy resources during sleep, other than sustaining your life, are to growth and regeneration. That's why we make growth hormone in the evening, right? Like growth hormone is the fountain of youth as far as the endocrine system goes. So it's remodeling tissues, providing you have all the raw materials because you live a healthy lifestyle that includes diet and appropriate activity. But if someone's injured and they're not sleeping, they're not going to recover very well. It's just, it's unfortunately the realities of it. Think about when you get sick, right? So think about something like a flu or a cold. What is your inclination if it's really bad?
Right, rest it.
You're sleeping. Yeah. Like you're sleeping 12, 14 hours a day if it's bad enough. That's a sign of what our bodies want to do naturally when something isn't well. That's when we rest and recover. It's the old adage, get some rest, drink some fluids, get some rest. And now rest could be not exercise, but part of rest is sleep. And for an athlete who's chronically training, all the things that they do on a regular basis are actually stress-inducing. So if they don't balance the balance sheet out at the other end, which is recovery-inducing, then they're going to start running their own deficit. and their progress, their gains, everything that they're hoping to have is going to be limited or compromised.
So if somebody's in that sympathetic state, say for instance, working out hard, working a stressful job, and they're not getting that relaxing time, that can also affect their ability to recover from certain injuries then.
Yeah, that's how you create an overtraining scenario. Train too much, recover too little. I mean, fundamentally, it's very simple on the surface, but knowing that everyone's different, right? But the important fundamental aspect to consider there is, if you examine yourself and examine your training schedule, most people put so much time into their training planning, but how much recovery planning do you do? How often do you take deload weeks? How often do you take a week off from exercise? How much sleep do you get every night? How often are you training harder to overreach? More sets, more reps, more volume. All those things start to change stuff. Then you add diet on top of that, and then the physical response. I mean, overtraining jacks up cortisol. That's catabolic. It suppresses growth hormone. It suppresses testosterone. Those are both anti-anabolic. So you're doing the same thing via different methods. People work out far too much for what they think they need to induce some changes. You know, back to me, I travel so much, so sometimes I can't get to a gym super consistently, but I mean, my body weight doesn't change super drastically in terms of muscle mass. Sometimes body fat based upon my diet and all that, but I still keep it pretty consistent. And when you are here, you can have periods where you train hard, but you can also have periods where you just kind of chill out, relax, and your body goes through kind of an aggressive recovery stage. And you might find that, you know, you take a month off of heavy lifting, you haven't lost a whole lot of strength when you come back to it. If anything, maybe you're stronger. Or maybe you seem to be able to perform at a better level. That's the like that super physical compensation thing that they talk about when it comes to training and recovery. So yeah, you're right. It's exercise is a stress. Anything you do that's a stress requires some kind of counterbalance, in my opinion. I'll always cite that because this is my brain sharing this information. So if we don't counterbalance appropriately, you start to run into a scenario where you start to get into a deficit. And you can only run a deficit so long before it starts to throw things out of balance.
So as we're becoming more technologically advanced, where does it end? Like, there must be a point where it's going to disrupt, say for instance, sleep or our ability to recover. When will people get that wake-up call?
It's a very, very interesting question. I think everyone will have their own unique wake-up call as something is like an imbalance that affects them. So if all of a sudden they're not sleeping at all anymore, they're going to start to think, well, what am I doing that's not sleeping? If they're getting sick when they think they're doing everything right and they should be healthy, why is this happening? The success in those scenarios is looking back in history. Model ourselves as close as we can to what humans did before all of this technological stuff came into play, because we haven't evolved fast enough to adapt to that. So it's important to know that those things, although amazingly beneficial to our life, it's changed our ability to assume information or amass information, assume a different role in a public sense. You're getting this information out to all of your listeners. It's great, but you know, listening to podcasts in the morning, especially on YouTube, is a better idea than listening at night from everything we've talked about today. So my suggestion is, I don't know how to say the absolute answer to when are we going to get the wake-up call. It's already starting, but people have to take their health into their own hands, because everyone's their own experiment. Everyone's their own scientist. Cool. That's an important fact.
Cool. All right, Roland. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap it up.
Cool.
Where can people find you, and is there any cool things that you have coming up in your life?
Yeah. They can find me on Instagram. It's RolandP_optimal_health, I believe. The Instagram handle will be shared in the show notes, I assume. And that's where I have most of what I do from an industry perspective. I'm off to Asia to go work the clinic I actually run in Manila, Philippines. So there I focus on health optimization and ketogenic dieting. And I'm in the process of still finding space to open my own clinic here. Probably going to be in York region, in Markham, Richmond Hill, somewhere in Canada. So my goal is to popularize this movement that I've helped to create and develop called Health Optimization Medicine. And it's the very first health-focused practice management. So I don't work off of a disease diagnosis. It's personalized medicine where you do functional lab testing to figure out what's going on inside your body in real time. And rather than detect rather than diagnose and treat a disease like the medical establishment does, I detect and correct imbalances, but I make no claims. However, if something that you have gets cleared up, then
bonus.
Awesome. Bonus.
Love it.
So yeah, you can find me there, Facebook, Roland Pankowicz, P-A-N-K-E-W-I-C-H. And if anyone has any questions, I'm sure they can get a hold of me through you.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Roland.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to Biceps and Banter with Brandon Crow. If you like our show, do us a huge. Subscribe, toss a review on iTunes, or maybe share the show with your friends. And if you want to know more, find us at fastingftw.com. Our Patreon is patreon.com/fastingftw.